This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to Where Did the Road Go? What you're going to hear tonight, I was initially going to have as a midweek podcast earlier in the week, but it turned out so good I decided to leave it for the main show. At this point, midweek podcasts tend to be more conversations with the primary interviews on the main show. But this one, despite being a conversation, like I said, I thought came out really well. We're discussing David Bowie and his occult connections, and knowing how much people love David Bowie, I figured we'll give this the main show this week. Now, if you're a Patreon, you already got to hear this earlier in the week. Anytime I do pre-recorded interviews, as soon as I have them ready to go, as a Patreon, you'll get access to them. If they're multi-parts that I do all at once, you'll get access to those, as well as some extra bits and pieces from various interviews that will never get aired on the main show. Patreon-only type of stuff. As well as some other special stuff coming out for Patreons very soon. It's only $3 a month. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com if you want to support the show. And without any further ado, here's tonight's show. We are here with Michael Hughes, Joshua Cutchin, and Red Pill Junkie. And we're going to be discussing David Bowie and his connections to various sort of esoteric stuff as it lays out in his music. We were going to do this a few weeks ago, but it was hard getting everyone on the same night for some reason. So a little late, but I think no less relevant. How you doing, guys?
Doing great.
Mike was flying around the world.
I was flying around my bar stool as well in Costa Rica. But it's good to be back. I missed the blizzard, so that was a beautiful thing. I came home.
Hey, your timing was impeccable.
Yeah, it was.
Missed it by a few hours, right?
Well, I was the last airplane flying out of BWI Airport, so. Literally the last airplane, the whole airport was empty, and one plane took off in front of us, and then we were sitting on the tarmac being de-iced, and I was going, please, let us make it. And we were the last out.
Yeah. Just a matter of performing an acceptable sacrifice to this no demon.
That's it. Yeah. It must have been those seven children I immolated before I left. So that took care of things. Oh, I probably shouldn't say that on the podcast.
All right. So David Bowie, of course, passed away a few weeks ago. And at the age of what, 70?
69.
69, okay. Everyone keeps dying around 69, 70 lately.
Yeah, it's a rough time for celebrities. I mean, the end of last year in particular was really rough.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like we tend to, in our zeitgeist, overblow celebrity death waves. But I've had a lot of people personally that I know have fallen upon hardships after the new year, and also some people that I know who have died, and other people I've talked to have expressed similar sort of concerns about this trend. It seems like a lot of people are going through some really rough stuff in the first 2 months of this year.
Bowie was big, though. I mean, I haven't really felt that same sort of collective shock wave. Really, I don't think since John Lennon, you know, as far as you know, big musicians dying. I mean, it really, my Facebook feed was nothing but Bowie for days and days and days. You know, I mean, it was, and it's surprising. You know, I mean, he was a you know, most people know his big hits and everything, you know, and I, you know, I always thought I was just one of those freaks that, you know, that really, you know, really dug the guy like I did. But then, you know, you really saw that a lot of people really connected with him, you know, for a lot of different reasons. I mean, you know, something about the guy was just bigger than life, you know, in so many ways.
And like Lemmy, he was going right till the end, which I think is how everyone should do it. Really?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Black Star album, you know, which was kind of his last album. Really, I mean, he knew that it was going to be his last album. So, you know, and you can tell that it's very much a final statement from the man. You know, it's deep, it's enigmatic, it's creepy, it's beautiful. You know, he really put his all into it. You know, it's like a final, really feels like a final testament from Bowie. You know, like, I'm going out and I'm going to do it my way, and I'm going to leave you scratching your heads and digging into this stuff. And it's all I've been doing. I've had the song Black Star as the worst earworm I've ever had. I mean, it won't go away. It finally went away when I was in Costa Rica, but you know, for weeks, you know, I would just hear verses from that, you know, popping up in my head. You know, it's better than, you know, God, like, you know, some god awful one of my kids' songs when that, you know, that happens to get in my head sometimes, that's for sure. Yeah. But you know, it's, so I'd love to hear, but you guys think along those lines too, if you've listened to the album much, or like, you know, how it affected you, because I have to be told to shut up, because I could just keep on. So please.
You know, the striking thing about Bowie, and I've heard some people say that perhaps the death of Michael Jackson was one of these cultural touchstones that possibly echoed this, but it seems to go a lot deeper than that for me. And as someone who is very familiar with his work, but at the same time wouldn't really consider myself a Bowie fan, like, it's I appreciate his work, and I'm not a Bowie fan. I own every one of his albums, but I don't consider myself a Bowie fan. Which I think speaks something to his particular discography. But it's really interesting because he's one of those people who was able to walk a bunch of different artistic lifestyles. I mean, you look at speaking to the latest album, Black Star, the music video for the title track Lazarus, and it is heart wrenching to watch that with the knowledge that he. It's not on a conscious level, at least on an unconscious level, knew how deep he was into his illness. And to watch that particular music video unfold with all of its imagery, which seems to resonate in a lot of ways that, you know, you look at a lot of music videos and they just seem to be obsessed with putting out cool imagery. But you feel like, I feel like Bowie, until the very end, was always layering stuff in that had multiple meanings and that would resonate in a conscious manner and an unconscious manner as well.
Okay, Red Pill?
Okay, so I cannot claim to be like the biggest David Bowie fan out there. I know that I like many of his hit videos, especially Space Oddity. You know, it really gets me on a very deep personal level. The thing that attracts me about Bowie is how he was so interested in many of the things that interest me, like the paranormal, the occult, and apparently also the UFO phenomenon, which was the reason why he ended up starring in movies like The Man Who Fell to Earth, which I feel is a must-see to anyone interested in this topic. And also the fact that David Bowie claimed to have witnessed having watched UFOs on several occasions when he was very early in his childhood. And also I think that when he was already an established and a very famous artist. There is this quote that was printed in this book, The Laughing Gnostic, David Bowie and the Occult, which was authored by Peter Koenig. And there was this is like the explanation that Bowie gave to this sighting he had, you know, while he was traveling across the English countryside with a friend. So it's a paraphrasing of the actual quote, but this is the gist of it. David Bowie said, "I believe that what I saw was not the actual object, but a projection of my own mind trying to make sense of this quantum topological doorway into dimensions beyond our own. It's as if our dimension is but one among an infinite number of others." So even though Bowie wasn't really an UFO investigator per se, I think this quote in itself is far deeper, far more interesting, and far more on point than what many UFO investigators have said about the phenomenon, you know?
Zero arguments for me on that point. I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, I think part of that, you know, I think of a lot of the people who were involved with the subject that I really admire have artistic backgrounds. You know, Bud Hopkins started out as an artist. Mike Clellan, another person who was, you know, an artist himself. I think that artists, and this isn't to diminish folks who are involved in more restrictive disciplines, but I think artists have the ability to articulate. Yeah. well, I didn't say it.
No, sorry.
No, we all want to be accountants, really. We all do. Okay? But I think that there's an ability to articulate some of the nuances in the phenomena there that a lot of people don't quite glom onto. And I don't know if that's the phenomena seeking out people who can articulate like that, or if it's the people who articulate it best seeing the phenomena. But either way, I totally agree with you, Red Pill. Spot on.
By the way, Josh, I always love your use of the word glom.
Do I do that often?
All right. So, I'm not that familiar with Bowie. I have a lot of respect for the guy, but I never really got into him. But he's always been an innovator, as far as I could tell, with all the different stuff he did. But who wants to get into a little bit of some of his esoteric connections?
Yeah, I can run with that ball for a few minutes. Yeah, I mean, Bowie was a magician, you know. I mean, a out and out magician, and sort of every way that word can be used. I mean, he was a magician of changing himself, of metamorphosing, you know, through these different characters from the Davy Jones, you know, pop singing about fairies and things like that. And then he became Bowie, then Ziggy Stardust and the Thin White Duke. And, you know, I mean, he was always just changing and metamorphosing. And, you know, with his sexuality, I mean, he came out as bisexual, you know, when it was, you know, very not cool to do such things. And I remember as a kid, when I was first becoming aware of him, you know, it was because, you know, one of my cousins would say, "Oh, he's gay, man," and things like that. But he really walked the border between all sorts of worlds. But even as between the male and female world, you know, he crossed the line like so many shamans do. You know, and exactly. You know, especially if you look at, a lot of shamanic societies from the American Indian to, you know, other cultures as well. The shaman is often like of indeterminate sexuality, you know, sort of an in-between. And again, that goes to that liminal state where things are one way and the other and all that. But when it comes to magic, I mean, he actually practiced magic for a while. And you hear that in his lyrics on the Station to Station album when he's talking about the Kabbalah and going from Kether to Malkuth, you know, on the various Sephirotes of the Tree of Life. And then he talks about the Golden Dawn. And he really did, you know, he went through a stage where he was actually a practicing magician of the Kabbalistic sort. You know, so his work has always had this mystic layer. You know, he was always a seeker. He was always clearly, you know, trying different methods to, you know, access his higher self or holy guardian angel, things like that. He was into Crowley's, Thelema. I mean, the guy was just, he was deep, you know. I mean, he was really, really, he was a practitioner. He wasn't just a dilettante. And then you look at some of the stories about him, though, especially the period where, you know, he was also heavily into cocaine, which coincided with the period of his deepest occult work that he was doing. And he really got pretty far out there. I mean, he thought Jimmy Page was doing black magic against him. He thought witches were trying to steal his semen. He kept his urine.
But who doesn't think that, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, they're out there and you have to be careful. But I mean, he was keeping his fingernail clippings and his hair and stuff like that, you know, sequestered away. Cause he, you know, cocaine, when you're abusing cocaine the way he was abusing it, I mean, it tends to make people very paranoid. So, you know, he was drawing sigils on it, you know, and pentagrams all over the place he lived with his wife, Angie. He was doing, you know, banishings all the time. And, I mean, he really got, you know, in his own estimate, he was just, you know, clinically paranoid. And at one point in an interview, I think it was, with Cameron Crowe, I think somebody, he said, I was hallucinating 24 hours a day. So, you know, when you combine heavy drug intake with deep, you know, really deep occult work like that, you know, it's usually a prescription for, you know, for disaster. And in his case, it, you know, it led to his flirtations with fascism and Nazism and stuff like that. You know, again, that he, you know, later interviews, he claims a lot of that was taken out of context and, you know, but he really went down the dark road, you know. Fueled by the immense amounts of cocaine, but also his paranoia from being, you know, from living in that magical sort of, you know, esoteric realm. You know, you threw that all in the mix, and man, he was in rough shape for a while.
But it's interesting to me that he gravitated. I mean, obviously, artists gravitate towards substances. As an artist myself, I'm aware of a lot of people who have had these issues. But also artists gravitate towards the occult, and it's interesting that he was such a poster child for both of those things. And it's not like he even like tried to, you know, you think about people being interested in these subjects in the modern day. I mean, I think that most modern artists would try to obscure it in some way, or they would try to downplay it because of the fear of some sort of backlash. But Bowie really wore it on his sleeve in a lot of ways. I mean, you look at the opening two lines to his song Quicksander, you know, I'm closer to the Golden Dawn immersed in Crowley's uniform. You know, it's right out front. And it really seems to me that he was speaking to satisfying his own interests versus, you know, some sort of interests, or rather trying to satisfy the public. And that's what he did until the very end, is that he did stuff for himself, which is truly admirable.
The thing is too, nowadays, like, it's really popular for pop stars to, you know, mention the Golden Dawn and the OTO and stuff like this, but I suspect they don't have a clue as to what they're really talking about, or, you know, any kind of deep interest. I know years ago you had Madonna talking about the Kabbalah, and, you know, it seemed like that was sort of just a pop version of it without any real deep meaning behind it. I mean, maybe I'm wrong there, but it seems like it at times can be a very pop culture thing. And then, of course, you get all the Illuminati conspiracies around it. You know? But I don't think there's a lot of musicians who actually get that deep into it. I don't think there's a lot of people that really go that deep into it. I mean, even in metal, I mean, you have a lot of bands who talk about this stuff, But so many of them, you can tell, are just kind of like they like the imagery, they like the idea, but they don't, they're not really deep into it. Unless you're dealing with Carl McCoy of Fields of the Nephilim or someone like that, or like the guys from Therion or something, you don't have that real depth behind it. And with Bowie, you have some depth behind it.
Yeah, and you're so right. I mean, nowadays with all these, you know, there's a site called Vigilant Citizen or something that's one of the worst offenders in this realm. But, you know, it seeks all the, you know, the Illuminati programming and all the, you know, videos and halftime shows and all this stuff. And it's
every
like,
every,
you know,
Super Bowl.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like, it's like you're being played, you know. I mean, these guys, you know, these Illuminati chasers, you know, they think they're on to something and they're just completely being played. You know, it's like a feedback loop. You know, the more these armchair sleuths decide that, you know, Beyonce's latest video is, you know, an Illuminati, you know, charade to control, you know, mind controlled assassins or something, you know, the more of this crap that comes out there, the more these artists use it and play it up. Yeah, but you're totally right. I mean, honestly, because being an occultist, you know, having, you know, dabbled, I should say more than dabbled in several different systems over years and years, it's hard work, man. You know, it's not putting on a robe and, you know, some cool, you know, goth makeup and lighting a candle, you know, I mean, it's work, it's memorization, it's, you know, learning, you know, Latin and Hebrew and, you know, all this other stuff. And yeah. So, I mean, I think it's probably very unlikely that a lot of these musicians and artists that, you know, affect an occultist persona actually have done the hard work, you know, that it takes to be serious about this stuff. Bowie clearly did, you know. I mean, he was not a dilettante, and that definitely, you know, put him in a different league than most of his peers, for sure. Mm-hmm. And could I throw one more anecdote that I love the story?
Sure.
He moved. I think it was in his paranoid, coked up phase. He moved from one house in LA to another, and he found out after he moved that the house he had moved into used to belong to Gypsy Rose Lee, and in that house she had painted a pentagram on the floor in one of the rooms. So he was convinced this house, there was some crazy stuff going on in this house. And then he became convinced that there was a demon and it lived in the swimming pool.
Ah, the swimming pool. Yeah.
So he convinced Angie, his wife, that they were going to exorcise the demon of the swimming pool. So they went out and he had his candles and, you know, whatever other stuff, you know, incense and, you know, wand or dagger or whatever. I don't know what he used, but he performed an exorcism at the swimming pool. And Angie, who was just kind of going along with it and thought he was cracked and didn't really believe that there was a demon in the swimming pool, she said the water began to bubble and a dark stain appeared at the bottom of the swimming pool. So, hey man, you know, he may have actually been on to the demon living in his swimming pool, it sounds like. Or he created it, right? Exactly.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's something that I mentioned beforehand before we started talking. It feels like just that he was, I mean, yes, granted, he had an interest in these sort of things, but it feels like he as a person, as we often see with a lot of different phenomena, was sort of a focal point for a lot of these phenomena to gather around. Yes, he was interested in it, but I'm not entirely sure that he you know, chicken the egg. I'm not entirely sure that he was interested in it and it happened to him, or if it happened to him and he was interested in it. But he definitely was, in terms of, you look at figures with his sort of international visibility, there aren't a lot of people who are as touched by the paranormal, for lack of a better term, as he was. And it's really, it's part of the reason that I, you know, when I found out that he had passed, it really hit me like a punch in the gut.
Mm-hmm. To me, one of the interesting intersections between David Bowie and all the Fortean phenomena is the fact that he starred in the movie The Hunger.
Yeah.
You know, alongside Susan Sarandon and what was the name of the other actress? Catherine Deneuve. So The Hunger is based on the horror novel written by a guy named Whitley Strieber, right? And this was years before Strieber wrote Communion and came out of the abduction closet, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. And many people in the field believe that both The Hunger and also Strieber's other horror novel, The Wolfen, are in fact some kind of artistic interpretation or some kind of, which were heavily influenced by the experiences that were happening to Whitley Strieber, but which he hadn't actually acknowledged consciously. So his artistic unconscious was feeding on it, and that's why he was portraying these vampire-like entities in The Hunger, which are very close to what people in the UFO field call the Nordics. I mean, David Bowie, you know, it's like the kind of like the perfect rendition of a Nordic alien. And so that's to me, that's fascinating how he even before Strieber was involved with the UFO phenomenon, David Bowie was already, you know, embedding himself into all of this.
Yeah. And I mean, also, you know, creating an alien persona for himself with Ziggy Stardust and, you know, and then in The Man Who Fell to Earth, Nicholas Roeg's film, where he is, you know, an alien from another world. And, you know, he always spoke about his feeling of sort of alienation as well. And, you know, there's been all this chatter since his death about him being a so-called walk-in. You know, that that idea is seemingly gained traction with a lot of people. And what interested me about that, I mean, I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not so sure about that. I have no real opinion on it. But in the lyrics to Black Star, you know, he says, you know, it's about his spirit rises a meter and then steps inside and then something else steps in. And this other thing that steps in bravely cries, "I'm a black star." So, you know, he kind of, maybe he was playing with that idea of another being. And what blew me away, kind of coincidentally, is Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics, the other half of the Eurythmics of Annie Lennox. He just gave an interview, and of course the headline for the interview, and he was linked with Bowie, by the way. He spent some time with Bowie, like everyone seems to have, you know, in the entertainment world. But he just, the headline for the article I just read about him was that he had sex with Stevie Nicks. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. But luckily, I don't care. But I read past that, and he claims that in 1970, he was in a car accident, and he went out of his body, and something else came in. And he says to the person interviewing him, he says, yeah, I'm not the person I was. Another being came into me. And that's who I've been since 1970. So, you know, and that had this little weird oblique connection with Bowie, you know, that really, when I read that, it really kind of set my mind, you know, spinning. But Bowie, he's always had that alien presence, you know, more so. And he, of course, he played that up and he invented that, but more so than really any other entertainer, I think. You know, if you ask people, if you had to pick a rock star that, you know, is an actual alien, you know, who would that be? Yeah. Maybe Michael Jackson after, you know, all his surgery or something, but Bowie's, I mean, you know, he lived that persona for so long, you know, like a chameleon, you know, some kind of alien chameleon, just shape shifting his way through life.
I mean, I would argue that like Robert Johnson touched on that some too, with his, you know, his sort of the lore surrounding him. But yeah, in terms of like, in terms of what we consider to be the, in terms of somebody playing that alien idea to the hilt, it's Bowie all the way.
All the way. Yeah. The star man, you know, I mean.
Now you were saying something about the way he writes lyrics too.
Oh yeah, yeah. Joshua brought that up, and a little earlier before we got on the air, and yeah, Bowie he used a technique he got from William S. Burroughs, and also Brian Geisen, who was an occultist as well, and that's of cutting up. You know, like Burroughs would take a newspaper and he'd cut up little sentences or words, and he'd mix them all up and he'd randomly place them in order. And what Burroughs started to find out, and the way he described it, he says, when you cut up reality, the future leaks through. And he would find that as he did these cut-ups from newspapers, they would actually predict things that he would find out would later happen. So Burroughs used it as like a divination tool. And I think that's where Bowie got it from. But a lot of his lyrics worked the same way. He would just, he'd write some things and then he'd cut it up, or he'd take a document and through different documents, cut them up, and then, you know, randomly put them in order and write songs based on that, which is, you know, a pretty cool way of, you know, it's kind of letting, it's kind of putting your subconscious to work, but also letting randomness kind of create your art, which I always thought was fascinating.
Well, and randomness, but also randomness like joined with constriction. You know, you look at a lot of the great artists, and every artist that you will ever talk to says that constriction breeds creativity. I mean, it's the entire reason that Schoenberg came up with Schoenberg embraced atonalism and then decided to go to serialism because it gave him some sort of structure to work with him. But also beyond that, you know, it really speaks to, it really speaks to this sort of like I Ching-esque way of approaching creativity as well, which is the first thing that I saw, because when you look at his system before, apparently he had a software algorithm developed for him, but when you looked at him like using the paper system, it looks so much like somebody like reading the I Ching. It's not even funny. There's a, if anybody wants to search for it, there's a BBC interview that resurfaced after his death, where it shows him like going through and shuffling all these different scraps of paper, and it's, you know, it's this wonderful thing, because it really is this idea of this modular look at creativity that I don't think really comes out a lot these days.
All right.
Yeah, that's a really good way to the modular description. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, I've actually used that a little bit myself, and it's great. It's a technique anyone can, you know, as soon as this podcast is over, just go and grab a magazine, a newspaper, anything. And there are even online, if you look up the cut up machine or something like that, I think it is, you know, you can plug in, you copy a piece of text from somewhere, put it in, and it will cut it up for you. I've always found, though, like with a lot of things, like with tarot cards, you know, I which is, you know, something I've been into since I was 11 years old. There are, you know, you can do your cards in a web browser, but for me, that's never quite the same. And it's never quite as on point as when you do something manually. So if you want to try the cut-ups, I encourage anybody listening. It's fascinating, and the little it's a good way to teach your mind. Like Joshua, like you were saying, it's a way to, you know, sort of modularize your creativity. And I've had some really dramatic stuff come out from cutting things up and randomly putting it back together, rearranging it. So it's a great occult technique. Or even if you can get the occult out of it, just use it as a great creative technique to get your creative juices going. So, you know, do it. And I think you will be really, really impressed with some of the stuff that comes out.
Those are excellent points. And also, you know, what it speaks to me is, too, is, you know, even the funny thing that a lot of people don't realize is when they like sort of push an option like that off the table, so they don't realize is that in being forced to like look at these different combinations, even if you don't like it, you'd be like, oh, well, I would like that if it said this. That's still part of the creative process, you know?
Exactly. Greg Bishop, who, as you guys well know, is about to publish his anthology, compilation of UFO essays. He had a lot of problem coming up with a title for it, and he ended up using this cutout system, and the system managed him to find this title, It Defies Language, which he finally chose for it.
I hadn't even put that together, but you're right, Greg. That's the exact... sorry, Greg, jeez. You're right, Miguel. That's the exact same system that Greg used. That's interesting.
Yep.
Now, Red Pill, you were saying that you were always interested in his labyrinth work?
Well, that was Joshua, but yeah, I'm also really fascinated by that movie because I think nowadays you will be hard-pressed to find a modern rendition of fairy tales, which would be as dark and as obscure as Labyrinth was. I mean, it really shows just how really dark and creepy the original fairy tales were. Because here in this movie, it's all about these trollish entities kidnapping a kid, you know, and also this the Goblin King being infatuated with a prepubescent girl. So all these really adult stuff, you know, put forward in what apparently is a movie for children, but if you really dig deeper, you find that it is not.
Yeah, this is where I cracked my knuckles, and this is where I decide to dive in. I have one of the more popular posts on my blog is this idea of I embarked on this effort to find the most fairy faithful cinema representation. Because there's a film that's come out, and it's already come out in the UK that I haven't seen yet, called The Hallows, which looked really promising. But it sort of sparked me on this quest to find the most faithful film to sort of fairy folklore. And you know, I have a soft spot for Muppets and Henson lore in my family, but I honestly did not expect that Labyrinth would come up as the most fairy faithful film. But and not to say that this is all sort of tangential. Not to say that Bowie had any real input. I think that there were some other people who were up for the role. I think not coincidentally, I think Mick Jagger was up for the role. Mm-hmm. And some other pop stars. Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson was up for the role too, which sort of, you can see what that would have been in his Captain EO role. It's sort of what you would have probably gotten out of a Michael Jackson Goblin King. But I was super surprised to find out how faithful Labyrinth was to fairy folklore. I mean, you know, first of all, you've got all these this vast array of Muppets masquerading as different types of goblins and fairies and things, and they're all of different shapes and sizes. Even Ludo is like looks like the Celtic Woodwose. Mm-hmm. But you know, the child is stolen in the beginning of the film. Jareth the Goblin King, played by David Bowie, is a taller entity supervising smaller entities, which is something that you see not only in fairy folklore, but also in alien folklore. There's this weird loosey-goosey time component to the film where he gives her, like, I think it's like 13 hours or 12 hours to complete her task, and it takes place in the course of one evening, which is, again, this time compression component that you see in fairy and alien folklore. But, you know, one of the things that obviously piqued my interest was Jareth gives Hoggle, who is one of the one of her companions, this troll-like being, a peach to have her eat. And she eats the peach and she passes out. And basically it gives her this altered state of consciousness by eating the peach, which definitely ties up with my own research. But, you know, beyond that, looking to what Bowie did and Bowie's role in this, it's interesting because his theme song for the actual film called Underground, I just noticed this a couple of weeks ago, features the lyrics, well, obviously down in the underground, which is, I think, sort of evocative of fairy lore. You know, fairies always used to live in fairy mounds under the earth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one lyric where one of the lyrics is, "It's only forever," which again, I feel like speaks to this sort of time component, this temporal component as well. But and the guy who was one of the primary forces behind Labyrinth was Brian Froud, who was one of the great artists of fairy imagery. There's an excellent 2000 documentary called The Fairy Faith, which is on YouTube. Anybody who hasn't seen it, who has any even a passing interest in this, should look it up now because it's fascinating. I generally watch it once a year. It's one of the few things in this genre that I watch once a year because it's so compelling. But Froud's featured in that as well, and he definitely expresses a very concrete interest in fairy phenomenon in terms of the way that he believes it interacts with our current worldview. But again, coming back to Bowie, Bowie's character is often represented in a lot of the Labyrinth scenes by an owl, which again, anyone who's familiar with the work of Whitley Strieber and Scream Memories, and also more prominently our good friend Mike Cleland, will recognize how that's, you know, quite significant. And I found it really funny. There was a 1982 film of a children's book called The Snowman. Are any of you familiar with this?
I am not. No.
No.
It's a very charming, wordless documentary set to this just wonderful score. It's almost on this like a colored pencil style. But the beginning of The Snowman on the television version, the televised version, my DVD doesn't have this, but the televised version of The Snowman was introduced by none other than David Bowie. And David Bowie comes on and talks about this interesting experience he had just in terms of like his childhood in England. And as soon as he finishes, within 10 seconds, the first image on the screen is an owl flying directly at the screen. So again, it's one of those things like, do I think really? There's any sort of greater meaning to this? Do I think that David Bowie orchestrated an owl appearing in The Snowman, or do I think that David Bowie had any real creative hand in Labyrinth? I don't. But he's one of these people that these sort of, if we engage in the synchronicitous philosophy, a lot of these phenomena, these things gravitate toward him in such a profound way that you just need to scratch a little bit and you can just see complex webs of interaction with what we would consider Fortiana.
Okay.
They're actually redoing Labyrinth too, aren't they?
Oh no, I hope not.
I actually heard that it was going to be a sequel and not a reboot. There was sort of a, and again, like, you know, they also announced about, geez, probably about 10 years ago, a sequel to The Dark Crystal, which has never materialized. So yeah. I would take that with a grain of salt. But from what I hear, the Henson family is intent on making it a sequel and not a reboot.
Okay.
I also even heard that they were planning to do a remake of The Man Who Fell to Earth, but I don't know what happened to that project.
Interesting.
So what about Bowie's Crowley connections?
Yeah. Well, you know, he like you know, anyone who decides to sort of pursue any sort of interest in the occult, you know, you can't help but wind up you know, with old Uncle Al in the picture somewhere. And I don't think he was a Thelemite per se, but I know he was deeply engaged in Crowley's style of magic. You know, obviously Jimmy Page was the most well-known aficionado of Crowley, you know, living at his mansion and all that sort of thing. And again, there was that Bowie at one point was fearful that Page was doing dark magic on him, and Bowie tried to protect himself and throw the dark magic back at Page and all that stuff. So, you know, he definitely expressed an interest in Crowley. I think later, you know, he sort of, especially when he got, when Bowie became sort of hit this weird little fascist phase of his, where he, you know, and a lot of what he said was kind of taken out of context, but he was clearly, he was deeply, deeply impressed at the Nazi, the way the Nazis used imagery, their uniforms, you know, the power that they projected, and he talked about Hitler as being the first real rock star, you know, which when you think about it, really kind of does make sense. You know, I mean, Hitler was more than just, you know, any old politician. You know, he had this almost, you know, occult, you know, of course there's, you know, been plenty of theorizing about the Nazi interest in the occult and the Thule society and their interest in recovering the Holy Grail. And, you know, there's a whole enormous mythology, you know, some of it,
right,
some of it more, you know, based in reality than others, but mm-hmm. You know, Bowie was also he was very much into Trevor Ravenscroft's book on The Spear of Destiny, which was about allegedly about the Nazis trying to recover the spear that pierced the side of Christ when he was on mm-hmm. the cross. He was very caught up in that for a long time, So what I see is what kind of was happening at this period in his career, in his life, is he started falling prey to the, you know, it's a real problem in occultism is when people get these kind of overinflated egos, you know, and they start thinking that they're, you know, almighty and powerful. And that's really always one of the consequences of occultism, where you see all the way back from the Golden Dawn, when the Golden Dawn just self-destructed and blew up, you know, it was always based on, you know, overinflated egos and people
right.
too mm-hmm. in love with their own power. And I think that's what was happening to Bowie at that point. I mean, he was fascinated by the Nazis. He talked about himself as if he could be, you know, some sort of fascist leader. He said, "I would have been a great, you know, fascist leader." And he did have an immense magnetism about himself. And you know, when you think of if he had, you know, really dedicated himself to politics or the dark side or something like that, I mean, he really might have gotten somewhere with that. But luckily, I think as he sort of, you know, that the left-hand path was taking him down a road that was leading him to self-destruction, you know, he sort of turned that around and abandoned, you know, he kind of shook himself out of that, whatever, that phase that he was in, where fascism was such a fascinating, attractive thing. And it really is like a, you know, it's a dark spot in his career. I think there was even a group formed called, like, Rockers Against Fascism or something, when he was quoted in a couple of these publications, you know, talking about his fascination with the Nazis and totalitarianism and things like that. So I mean, you know, in retrospect, years later, he really kind of pushed back and said, you know, that was crazy stuff I was doing at the time. So yeah, I think that his fascination with Crowley, you know, Crowley, who also was not the greatest human being, you know, and he was a fantastic right. musician, but, you know, left a couple of wives, you know, in the asylum or just completely financially wiped out and things like that. I mean, you know, I think Bowie probably was going down a similar track, and luckily for all of us, but more luckily for him, really, he climbed out of that pit that he was in. It probably had a lot to do with his stopping, you know, the massive amounts of cocaine that he was doing.
Right.
You know, he also stopped drinking at one point also. So, you know, he managed to pull himself out of that pit that so many musicians and artists, you know, kind of happened to fall into.
Okay. Is there anywhere else we should go with this? I mean, you guys are more familiar with Bowie than I am.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say something about anyone who's listening that hasn't watched the two videos that he's released from the Black Star album that Joshua mentioned earlier. I think Red Pill talked about a little bit earlier too. You really have to watch those videos. I mean, when I watched Black Star for the first time, I had chills. I mean, it's such a powerful example of his art. And how Joshua said earlier that he layered so much stuff. I mean, it is a smorgasbord of imagery. And I've heard that video dissected now from so many different angles as being about Isis, the goddess, as being about Isis, the crazy fundamentalist, you know, murderous folks, you know, terrorizing their people and beheading people and things like that. I've heard it as a Horus, Osiris. It's amazing. And it just goes to show how much that the man put into his art. I mean, it has rituals going on in it. It has, you know, imagery from his career as Major Tom. He's wearing an outfit in I think the Lazarus video. It's like a skin tight sort of suit that has white stripes on it, almost looking like lines of cocaine if you look at it that way. The same costume that he was wearing on the cover of the Station to Station album, where he's drawing the Kabbalistic Tree of Life on the floor. It's so beautiful and so dense, and it's amazing to watch people delve into it and pull things out of all that imagery. So if you haven't seen it, I'd be surprised if anyone listening to this episode in particular hasn't seen it yet. Just put that on, you know, turn out the lights, put your headphones on, and just be immersed in a piece of art that I feel is just stunning. And like his career, there's so many levels to it, and there's so many ways of looking at it, and it's got so much occult imagery, so much metaphorical stuff going on. It's just absolutely brilliant. And to think that he left us with that as like his parting gift to the world, I just think is phenomenal. You know, just go look up online how people are digging into these videos and how much they're seeing and how much, you know, either they're projecting or he put in there or a mixture of both. But I haven't experienced anything like it in a very long time.
Yeah. And something else that I would add to that is that it's not particularly comfortable to watch, you know, neither of those are. And I think that's something that is profoundly missing from a lot of our art these days, you know.
That's such a good point.
I mean, the first time you drink bourbon, it's not very pleasant either, but if you can acclimatize yourself to some of the more uncomfortable aspects, it becomes more pleasant. And a lot of Bowie's work, and it's probably the reason that I'm not as big a Bowie fan as I would like to be, is because a lot of what he has done has been quite challenging. But as far as other directions to take this, it's not like his acting roles were restricted to the films that we've talked about. I mean, he was also in a role in Twin Peaks, has a lot of occult connections as well. Sporting an awful southern accent, I might add, on Twin Peaks. But also, you know, again, it's like he tended to gravitate towards these very esoteric roles. One of the best things that I think he did in his latter years in terms of acting was his depiction of Nikola Tesla in The Prestige. Whether or not you like the film or not, he was transcendent in that role in terms of just what he was able to do with a limited amount of screen time.
Yeah, he's everywhere, you know? I mean, it's amazing how many people and, you know, I mean, he was around for a long time, certainly. But, you know, for the kind of things we talk about on this show, you know, almost, you know, he's hiding behind every little crack, you know? It's just stunning when you look at, you know, I guess, you know, the stereotypical idea, like the degrees of separation and in the fields, the stuff that we talk about, I mean, he's everywhere, you know, I mean, he's, you know, from the Strieber thing to, you know, I mean, he was born in 1947, the year of the, you know, so-called Roswell crash, the year Crowley died. I mean, it really is, it's shocking how interwoven he is with Fortiana, with the esoteric, you know, and that's really astounding to me that an artist, you know, touched so many different areas with his art.
True. You know, the way his last videos were there, and like you're saying about his last album, makes me think of Johnny Cash covering Hurt at the very end of his career and that video for that.
Yeah.
Where you knew, he knew that was near the end when he was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a Nine Inch Nails song that was, I thought was great to begin with, and made it 1,000 times better.
Yeah.
Like, and so much more when he did it, and you could, you know, see the imagery with him in it. That's what I was thinking of when I watched the Lazarus video.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be able to give a parting, you know, to know that you're dying, yeah, and to still have the, you know, the desire. I mean, a lot of people would just forget about their art and, you know, focus on their family or, you know, whatever. But I mean, to for him to remain so committed to his art that, and to give us something that is so powerful and so profound, and so much more so now that we know that it was his parting gift to the world, you know, I mean, that is just, it gives me chills, you know. I mean, I still, every time I listen, there's a song at the end of that album where he's talking about, I can't give everything, you know, he's almost saying, I've given it all, you know. And when you listen to that song in particular, a friend of mine, Gareth Branwen, who's a writer, alerted me to this. He said, put your headphones on and listen to that song, and you can hear Bowie's breathing. It's almost kind of labored breathing, but you know, most musicians, they don't want you to hear the breath. Sure. You know, but in their vocals, but you hear his breathing, and it made me wonder, like, man, you know, is he saying these are my last breaths too? Breaths. You know, and it was just so powerful. It's a really dynamic album, and I haven't gotten sick of listening to it yet. It's been on, you know, almost constant run whenever I listen to music. Just the fact that for an artist to know this is it, you know, I mean, this is my final chance to say something. What's it going to be? And like Joshua said, the fact that it's not all, you know, sweetness and light, you know, I mean, he went out giving us something that is dark and disturbing, but yet, you know, beautiful at the same time. I mean, it's got a really immense beauty, and it's a mixed bag of darkness and light, and you know, it's just what a powerful last thing to just put down, you know, put out there for all of us to listen to.
All right, anything else, guys?
A handful of thoughts. Another film role that can't believe I didn't mention earlier, which was really has been really not influential, I guess, but impactful, as much as I hate that word, upon me, was his role as Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Which is
a fantastic film. I think that anyone, atheist or Christian, should watch that film because it's incredibly powerful. But I would also be remiss if I would not acknowledge his progeny, which is Duncan Jones, who is one of the leading forces in modern hard sci-fi these days. His film Moon is transcendental, I feel.
Oh, yeah.
It's an excellent work of art. I feel that Source Code, the follow-up film, is less than so, and I have reservations about the World of Warcraft movie, but...
is he directing that?
He is. Which is the only thing that gives me hope for it. The guy who's who portrays Ragnar Lothbrok in Vikings is the starring protagonist, which I like the Vikings show as well. But I have great faith in what Duncan Jones does in general. Because even though Source Code I think was a lesser effort than Moon, it was still a great work of sci-fi.
I thought it was enjoyable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. My problem with Source Code is I wish that it had just like ended on one of the fatalistic kissing shots where they're just doomed to repeat the same thing over and over again. That probably speaks more to my sensibilities than it does anything else. But Moon is just one of those films that I think just comes along once in a generation, and I really and it's interesting to think that this guy grew up in the household of David Bowie, you know.
Yeah, and guess what? Was announced today. Duncan Jones and his wife are having a baby. And my first thought, of course, was, what if this baby has eyes of two different colors?
If only, right? my only tangential connection to Duncan Jones is that a good friend of mine's cousin was Duncan Jones's roommate for a while, but that's about it. Which I guess is closer than a lot of people, but still too far away to mean anything.
Well, that's a few degrees from Bowie, so that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Closer than any of mine. Although I have a friend that spent a whole day with Bowie once, so
that's,
I guess,
amazing. Are you serious?
I'm two. Yeah. He won some contest, and he went to New York and hung around the studio with David Bowie for like hours and hours one day.
That sounds like it'll be amazing, because I recently read an article that said that he used to carry around a Greek newspaper just so that people wouldn't ask him, because he'd be like, oh, the guy's reading a Greek newspaper. It must not be David Bowie. So here's something that might be, if we're starting to wrap up this whole endeavor, this might be a good direction to take it. Favorite Bowie songs? Anybody?
Oh, man.
Space Oddity for me.
Yeah. I'd say I've always been a big fan of Ashes to Ashes. I have to say, though, man, Black Star is so deeply embedded in my brain now. It's hard to shake. So, but before that... I think I wore out the vinyl of my Changes 1 Bowie and Changes 2 Bowie, so it's really hard to pick one. But there was always something about Ashes to Ashes that really, really got me there.
Yeah, I totally get that.
And I'm going to pass on it because I've never really listened that much to it.
Well, you've got to catch up, Soraya.
Yeah.
for me, it's always been Life on Mars.
Actually, I do like that song.
Yeah.
I liked it because it was in the TV series there.
Yeah, which the I haven't seen the American version, but the British version is fantastic. I love that. I love that show so much. But to me, that particular song conveys so much. So much emotion, and if you look at the vocal range of that song and what it like showcases, and also in terms of the stylistic range, it's a very broad spectrum stuffed into one song, so that takes the cake for me.
From what I do know, I would either go with Space Oddity, that, or so many metal bands have covered Moon Age Daydream. I'm not even sure if I know the original at this point.
Have you seen Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yes.
Yeah, it was in there when they go into Nowhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, I'm sure I've heard it, but what comes to mind are covers of it, because I've heard so many of them.
Actually, it's interesting. The day that Bowie, I don't know what this even means, but the day that I woke up and like the first thing I saw on all my news feeds was that David Bowie had died, I woke up with Moon Age Daydream in my head. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means, but it was.
It means you're tuned in, man. You're a star man too.
It probably means that my wife wanted to watch Guardians of the Galaxy the night before.
All right. Any other thoughts, guys?
Yeah. If I could plug a book, that is a friend of mine, Peter Biebergall. I think I mentioned it before. Biebergall, and his book is called Season of the Witch: How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll.
Nice. Yeah,
and man, it's, you know, of course there's a you know, nice big section on Bowie in the book, but you know, it's really if you're into the occult, if you're into rock and roll, if you're into that nice little Venn diagram where both come together, which I find endlessly fascinating, you got to pick up the book. I mean, it covers everything from, you know, folk rock through, you know, metal and, you know, the early kind of dark metal of Sabbath and Coven, all the way up through, you know, current, you know, sort of dark metal and bands like Sun and experimental stuff, prog rock. It covers it all. So, nice. You know, since we touched on that subject tonight, it's a book I heartily recommend. And if you get to, Peter's done some podcasts and things like that too. He's great. He's just a super knowledgeable guy and really fun to listen to. So again, the book is Season of the Witch: How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And if that's, you know, if that's your wheelhouse, you really need to read that book. It's totally fascinating.
Cool. Red Pill?
I had just found, you know, just right after he died, Bowie, there was obviously a ton of articles about him. And Adam Gourightly, who, as you may know, he's like a guy who's keeping the flame of Discordianism alive. He posted this link on his Facebook page about the very first appearance of David Bowie on television when he was just 17 years old. And it was kind of like, obviously it was some kind of publicity gimmick for his then band, the Manish Boys, but in a way it was also some kind of like a Discordian act on it in itself, because he and his band members were there on this BBC program as quote-unquote representatives of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Long-Haired Men.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's this very old black and white, like, 3-minute clip on YouTube, which you can watch David Bowie, you know, sporting this, you know, very, very 60s long hair and saying how they were tired, you know, of why other people should persecute us because of our long hair and all that. So it's, yeah, showing how Bowie was always making fun of the rest of society in a way, right? You know, like always having the upper hand and the last laugh.
Nice. All right, anything else, guys?
Well, just to quickly piggyback off of what Miguel said, there are a lot of clips of David Bowie making cameos and doing different comedy sketches and whatnot, and it's interesting that his death coincided very closely with someone else who I really admire, Alan Rickman. And one of the quotes of Alan Rickman that I've always cited, which is one that David Bowie seemed to live by, was that Alan Rickman once said, "I take my work very seriously and myself not at all." So, nice. So which I think is might be a fitting way to end this evening.
Well, let me throw in one more very quick thing, because now
that or not, Jesus, damn it, Michael, you killed my moment there.
Sorry, but you brought up Rickman, and there was actually, you know, I've discovered this on Facebook too. Someone posted it. There's a Simpsons episode, and I think I've gone off on how synchronistic Simpsons has been in my life. There's a Simpsons episode where with Alan Rickman, when I think it's, you know, it's one of their crazy musical bits, and Alan Rickman just pops up, and they're playing a Bowie song. I think it's All the Young Dudes or something like that that mm-hmm. he covered. And so there was the coincidence of Rickman and Bowie in The Simpsons, you know, which I'll just throw that out there. But, you know, the fact that they died around the same time, and, you know, here The Simpsons had them featured kind of right next to each other, just as yet another one of those damn Simpsons synchronicities that
Simpsonistic.
It's Simpsonist, Simpson chronistic.
There's a book there. Somebody read the book.
All right. Thank you so much, guys.
All right.
Our pleasure.
So yeah. much fun, as always.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. And we can't play any David Bowie to end the show because, well, we don't have the rights for it. However, what I do have the rights to play is a cover of a David Bowie song, that being Moon Age Daydream by a band called Static People. And Static People are from San Francisco. They have a couple of EPs, maybe an album out. I forget exactly. Some pretty good stuff, though. Very unusual sounding. And I absolutely love this cover. So here we go. Static People, Moon Age Daydream. See you next week.